This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
I am particularly pleased that Nicholas Dirks and Claude Steele have agreed to talk with us today about this critical topic, undergraduate education in the public research university. I'm going to give a very brief introduction because I think most of you know the chancellor and the provost. Nick is the 10th chancellor of Berkeley. He's a renowned historian and anthropologist who focuses on India. Before he came to Berkeley, he was vice president of arts and sciences and dean of faculty at Columbia. Claude came from down the road at Stanford. He's the dean of the School of he was the dean of School of Education at Stanford, and he was also at Columbia as provost. He's a social psychologist. He works on identity issues, particularly the self-image of minority students and its relationship to performance, something was relevant to some of the presentations we heard earlier today. So I'm going to begin with a question that is simple but fundamental, which is, what do you each think should be the purpose of an undergraduate education in the 21st century?
You usually go first, and then I get in your tracks. So let's keep that partnership going.
Yeah, the first thing I want to say is I'm just I'm thrilled that that Carol and others here have put the effort into creating this opportunity to talk about undergraduate education in the public university. For the last 3 years since I've been at Berkeley, and I came here, as Carol said, from Columbia, I have been thrilled to be part of one of the world's, one of the country's greatest public universities, to have the opportunity to lead it, but also to have to think through what it means to talk about a public university at a time that is very, very different, both from when public universities were established, for the most part in the late 19th century, although University of California kept spawning them, But now, and then, of course, having watched the way in which they became so critical to the ecosystem of research universities in the United States during the 20th century, but now in the 21st century, a time when funding from the state would suggest that we're actually at least more than half public, if not more than that. And, of course, with a whole variety of constituencies that demand from public universities ever more in every conceivable direction. But the focus on undergraduate education is central, and in my view, it's also central to the mission. It was central to the mission in the beginning. It's central to the mission now. And the strength of a place like Berkeley, I taught not only at Columbia, I've taught at the University of Michigan. The strength of these universities, these great public universities, is that they've established top leading graduate programs, as good as any, in some instances better than most in not only other universities, but in private universities. But the challenge has always been how to create an opportunity for undergraduates, which both parallels in quality in terms of the experience and in terms also of the learning of what is available in smaller private, not just universities, but colleges. But how to do it in a way that also leverages the extraordinary strength of the university at large. And I think we'll have an opportunity to talk a little bit about that during the next hour. But in terms of what we are looking to do as educators for our students in this new century, I think I'd just say a few things. First, I think we are still tasked with the fundamental mission statement of the liberal arts and sciences. That is, of course, something that's evolved over time. I'm sorry, I keep going backwards in time. I'm a historian, so I do that. But it's evolved over time, and it's changed in fundamental ways. And, of course, it's also become sedimented in very different kinds of resolutions in different universities. And so the history of undergraduate education and the theories of undergraduate education in some sense get displayed if you take certain institutions and you use them to say, you know, Columbia, core curriculum, started in 1919, ended in 1947. That's sort of what happened there. Brown, in some sense, going from the Harvard experience of introducing the elective and then stressing choice on the part of students. I went to Wesleyan University, which I went there the first year that both parietal hours were disbanded and distribution requirements were disbanded. And if you don't know what parietal hours are, you're a lot younger than I am. But you know, the emphasis was on choice, was on the student crafting their own path, and of course then achieving their own end. But it seems to me that critical thinking is more important than ever, and I think most educators agree with that. And yet the question, of course, is what does that mean, and how does it get translated into a new curriculum and a new time? So one of the things we've done here at Berkeley as part of our undergraduate initiative, which we launched when I came here 3 years ago, and I've been working with some of the people here in the audience, and I've been struck by already how much has been done and the goodwill and extraordinary ideas that are propelling us towards, I think, what are going to be really important contributions to the discussion across public education. But what we've been trying to do is to find some things that we can introduce that students will have in common. And it's not so much content as it is a set of aspirations around areas of learning. And of course, the end really being the capacity on the part of students to continue to learn how to learn, so that they will enter their postgraduate life with a capacity to continue to move through the dizzying pace of change taking place with respect to virtually all parts of our lives, whether you think about changes in technology, whether you think about the changes associated with globalization, whether you look at some of the challenges that that we have from climate change to global inequality. And, of course, flagship universities see themselves doing all sorts of things, but one of them is actually educating the leaders of tomorrow. So what does that entail? And the one substantive example I'll give of something that has been introduced by our faculty here is a pilot course that is growing both in size and I will say also in success around data science, data analytics. And the notion has been not so much to teach coding or standard computer science, although a lot of our students, of course, are seeking that education, but rather to teach a kind of critical numeracy, to think of critical numeracy as in some way an extension of critical thinking in an age in which so much of our knowledge world is driven by not just data, but very large sets of data, and very large sets of data that then get interpreted or translated into propositions about us as consumers, about us as citizens, about us as voters, about us as members of an urban community, us as drivers of cars and traffic, et cetera, et cetera. And, of course, we know, all of us here know, because we work with data, that data is not, that algorithms that work with data sets are themselves interpreting those data sets, and we know that data sets have been constructed out of a non-neutral reality. That is to say, they themselves have a particular take a particular slice of the world, and they take it in ways that obviously fact-based. We all talk about fact-based, evidence-based, but that have to be understood in terms of the constitution of those data sets as much as in terms of what you do with them. And we're trying to teach that to all of our students in ways that will then connect with how they envision their own interests and take their own electives. So I'll stop there.
Do you want to add anything?
Well, I'm a psychologist, and so perhaps my general thinking about that question is shaped by that perspective. I do see the college years as a developmental period in a person's life, and that in part we're as institutions tending to that development. And there are a lot of things you hope people gather, critical thinking, some capacity at self-examination, some sense of where they fit in the larger world and what the larger world is and what the values are that are critical to their lives and so on. So I do think there are a lot of skills that we think of that are very implicit that a good university and a good university experience helps individuals to develop in a good way. I also think it's a time when people, hopefully, when it operates at its best, when they fall in love with something that a course of life, a path of life, and certainly a path of work, but learning, investigation, they really get excited about something, and that you begin to take on that kind of an identity as well as the other identities that you've always had that brought you into that situation and that are going to be a part of you. Something else gets added as a critical North Star for you. And that can lead to a profession, that can lead to many things, of course. But I think it is an opportunity in a person's life where if that happens, it's a very good thing. And in relation to public universities, I think our research opportunities especially can be helpful in developing that kind of thing. People can see inside a line of work and scholarship and research, and that tends to be a very exciting avenue of access to things that is more exciting than what they can read in a textbook or what they can prepare for in taking a test. So that experiential offering we have, I think, is a powerful part of what a major public research university, or really for that matter any research university, can offer to undergraduates. I can go on, but I'll stop there.
No, that's really interesting. I want to expand on what you just said, because I it sounds like for you an education in the 21st century is very much, or maybe it always was, about identity formation. Mm-hmm. But identity formation not in a narrow sense, but a really broad sense that involves intellectual passions, intellectual experiences, as well as the things that we, in a more kind of common conversation kind of way, associate with identity. Mm-hmm. And I'm interested in how that process of identity formation that you describe is distinctive in a public university as opposed to another kind of campus. Or perhaps it isn't, but I'm really interested in getting at what are the distinctive character and perhaps the distinctive challenges.
That's interesting, you know, because I wouldn't say I see a major difference between public, private, or liberal arts major research universities in that regard. I think all of them provide this opportunity to for identity development and to take on a new identity that's going to steer your life and in all kinds of ways, structure your life in all kinds, your relationships, your profession, your income, lots of things will flow from the kind of identity formation we're talking about. I do think big public universities have a challenge in accomplishing it. It maybe is a little easier for some of these things to take hold. First, let me say I think it happens. It's scaffolded by good curriculum, interesting professors, contact with faculty, contact with mentors, access to scholarship and research, things that are going to be exciting. Those are the things that scaffold this kind of identity formation I'm talking about. So I would then take that lens and say, how does a public university, does it have challenges in sustaining that scaffolding? That maybe some other universities have a little bit easier time doing, because we have large numbers. I know you've been talking about faculty-student ratios. We have many things that challenge that to some degree, but we do have great strengths, and I was pointing first to those, the amazing. If you can hang in there, you're going to walk into one of the most exciting wonderlands of research and scholarship that you could ever imagine on a campus like this. So we have huge strengths. I think we've done a lot of thinking about how to make those first 2 years years that give people a common enough sense of themselves. And a sense of what's at stake here in their college lives, that we as a big university can help steer them into these kind of experiences.
Yeah, just to add a little bit, but this in fact does grow out of conversations, again, that we've had not just with each other, but with many of you here today. You know, the scale provides the kind of excitement, in fact, that people want when they go to cities. More and more young people want to live in cities, you know, and we see that very clearly here in Northern California. But in a way, what the university, what the public university provides, whether it's in Bloomington or Berkeley, is a kind of scale of interaction, at least within the space at the campus, that has that buzz of an urban center. And the diversity and the opportunities and the interactions are incredibly valuable, and I think actually do provide a counterweight to the kind of individualized attention that can be provided at a smaller liberal arts college, right?
Yeah. One of the I think odd features of our college and university life is that from the moment a first year student comes in the door, you are trying to convince that student that belonging to this particular university, whether it's Hiram College or it's Stanford University or it's Columbia University or the University of Michigan or Berkeley, means something fundamental to their identity.
Yeah.
You know, you become a, you know, for Smith, it was a Smithy. Mm-hmm. And I'm interested in what that affiliative moment means for a public. Is there something different in the identity that students either take on or you're asking them to take on when they walk in the door as opposed to going to a Stanford or a Columbia? Is there something distinctive about the public nature of things or not? It could be not.
You know, I have a cynical thought that comes to mind. Some universities that forming that kind of an identity, a sense of that university being a part of who they are and as a lifelong identity, it's part of the financial model.
Let's of course, of course. But maybe that has to become more the financial model here.
And that's maybe a little different at Publix. Maybe that's the difference. We haven't. We often talk about this. We do need to emulate our private peers, perhaps more in developing that kind of an identity in our public universities, so that they do have this sense of being that, you know, being part of this institution and being responsible for the institution over the course of their lives. That's a so we've certainly had that conversation coming at it from that angle.
But, you know, I think I've found here in California, not just because of Berkeley, but because of the whole UC system, a recognition of the value of a public institution qua public that is different even from what I experienced at the University of Michigan. Now, you know, big chill, we know. Michigan produces a huge kind of sense of identity and loyalty, and they also are raising a lot of money these days that way. But at UC, the public university has been so much a part of the history of the state that I think it's a little different.
It's a little different.
And so people are, and this is true for students, it's actually true for faculty, they're much more self-conscious about coming to a public vis-a-vis a private.
Yeah, I think that's right.
And, you know, I really think that inflects everything we do at the institution. And what it, among other things, occasions then is precisely that question, what does it mean to be in a public institution? Mm-hmm. And especially now, what does it mean, as I mentioned when I was reflecting on your first question, what does it mean at a time the state isn't really paying for it? Because, you know, students are providing through tuition the single largest revenue source for the operation of the university, even if it's a lower tuition than the privates.
So both of you mentioned scale as one of the great challenges of the big public flagship universities. What are ways of mitigating the kinds of disadvantages of scale?
Well, lately, before I answer that question, I think we should be proud of scale and the fact that we do such amazing scale with such really modest resources in some way. I think that reality isn't as appreciated about us in the larger public discourse about higher education. And we have, you know, a faculty here roughly the size of an Ivy League faculty, but we do educate. Offer the opportunity for a first-rate education to maybe three times as many or more than that. And we don't charge, 40% of them don't pay tuition. I mean, there's quite a story to tell about the achievement of major public universities and their efficiency at providing high-level education opportunities to students. And that's something we struggle to get out there. So I'm probably primed to take any opportunity I can to get that out there. And I think for us, we have been trying to do a great deal of thinking about how to mobilize that scale to create a kind of an experience that ushers students into this wealth of opportunity in a big university like that. And as Nick was saying earlier, to create a sense of common experience as early as we can in the undergraduate experience, a sense of common intellectual identity, general intellectual a mission in life that's built on critical thinking, that's built on seeking knowledge and information, that's built on curiosity, that's built on that set of academic values that are core. To get that in there very quickly, in big publics, the rival pressures are you come into a big place and you learn what it's all about from just the people who are most immediately around you, and that may lead you into a frame of mind that causes you to leave a lot of opportunity on the table, to miss a lot of what's really there. And I think that's one of the big challenges of public. You ask how we do it. I think that that's the challenge, and how we do it is to, in our case, is to try to programatize, institutionalize this common experience.
But again, the challenges are huge in doing this, and I think we have to acknowledge that. You talk about scale, and I want to add to that. Again, everyone from Berkeley knows this and is proud of this, but a third of our students, our undergraduate students, are Pell Grant eligible, which means they come from families making less than $45,000, $50,000. And when you actually even look at other public universities, the University of California is very, very strong in that kind of socioeconomic diversity. So you both have a lot of students. You also have a lot of students from very difficult backgrounds. Now, that actually produces, in turn, in some sense, greater challenges for the university, because you have people without necessarily the same kind of educational background or cultural capital or social experience that allows them to immediately hit the ground running when they come to Berkeley. Many people, many students come here. It's a dream to come here. But then once they get here, it's very daunting. And so, that's... And to give... Again, a sense of scale. If you take UCLA and Berkeley together, the two routinely top-ranked public universities in most of the rankings, and you look at the number of Pell Grant students both institutions have, that's more Pell Grant students than not just the entire Ivy League, but the top 15, 16 private colleges and universities in the country. That's Ivy Plus with Chicago, Stanford, Hopkins, Wash U, and a few others. But that is a huge kind of opportunity, but challenge. So one of the things in thinking through a common experience intellectually is precisely to provide opportunities and channels, really, for students to engage each other across often very different kinds of social, ethnic, racial,
even national backgrounds. But we also have recognized that we need to think about not just the intellectual identities, but we have to actually think about where students live. What is the residential experience? How does advising help students make connections between and among different segments of life? And all of these are often administrated, as it were, in separate domains. And so connecting them, as they have been in smaller private institutions, is a challenge, but it is something we're working on and thinking about and trying to fashion a plan for that will work at this scale. And even in a context where we know that almost all of our undergraduate students after 2 years will probably live off campus housing, trying to create identities with houses and dorms and residence halls that might actually continue wherever they might live throughout their four-year career.
Well, we've done some speaking already about student-faculty ratio in this conference. And, of course, one of the characteristics of public research universities is they tend to have larger student-faculty ratios than their private counterparts. Do you think that student-faculty ratio is always an index of quality?
Not for us to admit to that. No. You know,
I was going to see which one of us was going to say that first.
Yeah. Our mission is to is to find ways that use the scale to sort of electrify the undergraduate experience, that take advantage of it, that creates such a strong and varied and interesting undergraduate community that with so many options that you get the positives, you get the excitement and the sense of possibility. It's like living in New York, let's say, or San Francisco, or where there's huge scale that itself has a very inspirational, generative dimension to it, and we do feel that here, that in this is a big, powerful place with a lot of good energy, and our aim is to harness that in ways that make it not, because it's so easy to stereotype it as the alienating experience of a student in a class of 750 far away from the professor and with no sense of connection to it. And that's what scale is, but scale can be something else too.
But we would like to have more faculty. There's not a department in the world that doesn't think it would be better if it wasn't bigger. And certainly every department here feels that way. And the strain on departments and on faculty is significant, and it has to be commented on. I think the thing that I've been impressed by, both at Michigan and at Berkeley, however, is the extent to which faculty really do take their teaching seriously. And some of them, take the lecture hall as a stage in which they establish a different kind of relationship with students. But, from Robert Reich to Randy Scheckman, we have performances that Broadway would be envious of every day. And, of course, then we rely on advisors. We rely on graduate students. We rely on lecturers. We rely on a variety of instructors. And we've been working very hard as an institution to provide training to all of those different groups and to engage them in the process of undergraduate education in a meaningful way. Now, the truth is that if anybody's from Harvard here, close your ears. But the truth is that a lot of students go to Harvard, and their primary interactions for the first couple of years are with TAs as well. It's not just the publics. But I think that there is a kind of recognition that this is hard, but that it's fundamental to the mission we have. And I really have been impressed by that. And this is, again, I mentioned Randy Scheckman. He got a Nobel Prize 2 years ago. He was in the press conference talking about the prize, and then he said, "I'm sorry, I have to go. I'm teaching a freshman seminar." And you know, again, not every freshman takes a Nobel laureate. It takes a seminar with their Nobel laureate, but it happens enough that it becomes then part of the lore, part of a kind of generalized experience, and then in turn becomes the basis on which, and we see this every year when we give our Distinguished Teaching Awards, you have alums who come back and say, you know, that professor changed my life. And you get that here with the same kind of regularity you get it at the Smiths or the Wesleyans.
I'd ask a question on a different topic now. Chancellor Dirks, globalization has been very important to your vision of what you want to do at Berkeley. And I wonder if you could you talk about that in relationship to undergraduate education in comparison to many privates. A fairly small percentage of Berkeley students study abroad, about 6%, I think. So how do you take that vision of globalization and make it inform undergraduate experience?
Well, you know, it is certainly the case that we have very active study abroad programs both at Berkeley and through the UC system, but they still reach a very small percentage of students, as you said. And it's in that context that that I began thinking about other ways, perhaps, to make sure that students have some experience of globalization. So one of the kinds of core competencies that we've established in regard to thinking around the curriculum and or curricular reform vis-a-vis the undergraduate initiative is to make sure that some kind of global competency gets introduced into a curricular experience. That's not us alone, but we I think, recognize across the institution that globalization means for students graduating in the 21st century that there's a much higher probability that they're going to be doing some part of their lives, whether they're working in business or a nonprofit or technology or what have you. They're going to be working both in global contexts, and they're going to be working with people from all over the world. But we also, in thinking through how to use the Richmond Field Station campus, which is 10 miles to the north, have envisioned some future day when we can have the Berkeley Global Campus that will regularly bring faculty and students from around the world at greater levels than you can bring in through international student admissions and the campus directly, and for shorter term stays, part-time, semester, even a couple of weeks in some cases. And in time, we hope we can introduce into the mix opportunities for undergraduates to do everything from short-term courses to internships that will, again, confer on them international experience. But it will be a different kind of global study, say, than, you know, the year abroad in France. We still have the year abroad in France. I mean, that's great. We have to think out of the box. But again, particularly at this scale, if we really want all students to have both some curricular exposure and some experience of the global. So the idea there is if you work even as an intern with a technology firm that's thinking about scaling up in Southeast Asia, you have some serious way to engage the cultural, social, economic, political kinds of questions that would be part of that. Through the internship and its relationship to how we're both exposing students to and engaging them in courses with some of the critical global issues of our time.
One of Berkeley's most important core values, this is going to be my last question, then I'm going to open up to the audience for questions. One of Berkeley's most important core values is diversity. What are ways in which both of you think that the university can make the diversity of its community a learning experience for all students?
Mm-hmm. Well, I do think diversity is a huge underappreciated resource in our general society, and I think also on campuses. In my science, I've seen diversity of the scientists add tremendous breadth and depth to the science because people bring in different perspectives, and I like to help students see that is everybody's bringing something to the table and belongs in that regard, that your particular perspectives can be very helpful, very useful in expanding the enterprise of scholarship and research and the like. So I think there's a way to present it that can be empowering and help people really see their sense of connection to the enterprise. And in that, you know, I think a lot of the research I've done in my life has focused on how that can go awry. I come into a university setting, and I may feel, because of general views of my group, stereotypes about my group's abilities, for example, I may feel some threat, some sense of disease, and not belonging in the situation, and that can make me so vigilant and worried about that particular identity that I can't get to the task of forming this other identity that is sitting at my feet as an opportunity. And so that dynamic is something I've thought a good deal about, and is a challenge of diversity. It's diversity is such an important strength, but we want to get better at solving this other problem so that it can be fully empowering to everybody.
Yeah. We were talking particularly about this morning, particularly about the attrition of underrepresented minority students in STEM. I know that's a subject that you thought about, and I wonder whether there's anything that you would like to add about, particularly about the STEM issue and the fact that about half of the underrepresented minority students that begin university expressing the intention to major in a STEM discipline drop out, a very substantially greater percentage than majority students.
Yes, I think that these identity dynamics I'm talking about play a much bigger role in driving that phenomenon than we generally appreciate. We think of instruction as almost entirely a matter of cognitive preparation and so on. And this, I certainly did as I got into this research. But over time, you begin to realize that if you feel like you're not being perceived well, or as promising, or as belonging, and you're vigilant. You're analyzing cues in the situation because you want to know how your identity is an issue here. That's a very distracting and laboring, onerous kind of thing, and it can pressure you to seek another easier path of life. So, you know, women tend to leave those fields not because their grades are bad, but the relationship between their performance and whether they stay or leave is almost, the correlation is almost zero. Whereas for men, if we leave those fields, there's a very high correlation. We haven't done very well, and so we're leaving. So that bespeaks a statistic like that, the role that these identity dynamics can play. And I just don't think we have been, it's very difficult for us Americans to want to take on issues of identity. We kind of want to reduce that away out of the picture. And to understand the problem through a different lens, and that's kind of where we're at. I think we adults, we leaders, have to be more open to the role that these things play, and begin to address them, take advantage of them, and I think we'll see some changes in our patterns of participation that we worry about so much.
Now I'd like to open it up to you for questions.
Hi, I'm Candace Till. I am. I was abandoned by Claude at Stanford University after bringing me there. But it was okay because I know one of the major reasons is exactly the conversation we were just having around coming to Berkeley, and which is my alma mater, so I also forgave him for that point. But coming to Berkeley to make it a model flagship university for inclusive excellence, and I'm curious. In the time that you've been here, what kinds of actions have you taken to create that? And what have you learned from those actions that would be instructive to the rest of us that are trying to create environments of inclusive excellence?
Mm-hmm. There's that drinking from a fire hose phase, which I think I'm beginning to get out of a little bit. So I offer that as an excuse for maybe not having made as much progress as one might aspire to. But I think both of us are that this is one of our primary priorities. We have focused a lot with Kathy Koshland, who's sitting there with an undergraduate initiative that is trying to put in place one concept, one term for it is a Berkeley College that will have both the kind of curricular dimensions that Nick was describing, but that would focus on pulling the undergraduates together in this new identity, forming an academic, more curiosity-driven, critical to do more to concert that identity in our first 2 years of experience at Berkeley, and not let those 2 years of experience be sort of laissez-faire guided. And in that way, our hope is that we will begin to see some of these unwanted identity dynamics reduce in the impact or lower in the impact they have on the course students take as they go through Berkeley, and in order to do that there are parts of this initiative in addition to curriculum there are threads through it's a vertical program, so there are threads through the curriculum to the second, third, fourth year that give people a sense of order and where they're going and make that kind of decision making easier. And then there are also things in the residence halls. We have them for our first year here. They're in a dorm for our first year, and then they're dispersed. So we need to make that first year an experience where again this other identity becomes the common shared identity that makes some of these other dynamics less problematic in some ways. So I'm giving you theory more than what we've actually accomplished, but that's how we're thinking about it.
Hello, my name is Sarita Alexander. I am staff here, an analyst after being an undergraduate and a graduate student here at UC Berkeley. And my question has to do also with diversity and creating an inclusive environment for students. We have over a half a decade of worth of data from our UQ's surveys showing that undergraduates are experiencing negative experiences are coming from other undergraduates as opposed to from teaching instructors or staff. And our colleagues at the University of Minnesota presented yesterday at this conference sharing similar results, and our UCY campus climate survey results showed the same thing, that it's this peer-to-peer exclusion that's happening. In our survey, our Berkeley campus climate survey, we actually asked about exclusion from study groups, and we found that a large proportion of African-American students as well as transfer students were reporting that they had been excluded from a study group as a result of their group membership as either a transfer student or an African-American. So I'm wondering what you all plan to do as part of the undergraduate initiative to create a more inclusive environment, focusing specifically on undergraduate training of some sort. I know that faculty are going through something. The GSI Teaching and Resource Center are teaching GSIs on how to handle these kinds of conversations in the classroom. But what's actually going to happen for this peer-to-peer interaction that's happening?
Boy, it's a daunting a problem, and I think it is quite a serious problem at Berkeley. The data show it over and over again. We're not the only university that has it. I know the data from big publics. I don't know the data so well from our private peers. Maybe it's different there. I'd like to think that when you have the infrastructure you need to create a more cohesive community, you get less of that. I'd like to think that is the case. But again, I appeal to the larger mission of the initiative is to
deal with that directly. I can't claim at this point that we have taken that on as explicitly as we should, because I think to some degree, at least I think in both of our experience, there's been a growing realization of how important it is. And how central it is to the experience of undergraduates. We have an obvious critical mass problem with African American students and with Latino students too. And that is true throughout the UCs. I think it's true throughout the flagship publics these days, but especially in states like Michigan or California, where you have no affirmative action, and as the critical mass goes down. You're now a member of a much smaller minority, and you just feel like that is more of a factor in your experience maybe than you've ever felt before, and it puts you in a vigilant mode, a worried mode, and you're having to kind of sort through what does it all mean all the time. That is allocating an awful lot of energy to understanding and coping with that experience that can't be devoted to the curriculum and task at hand. And there are a host of intervention programs. There's a growing literature. We have ourselves a good number of programs, but I don't think I could claim at this moment that we have a genuinely integrated approach to that problem, because I do think it involves both working with the students involved, and I think with faculty. A lot of these things and comments that come up in these surveys are actually made by faculty in relation to student groups. So I think the whole community is going to have to be engaged in awakened and engaged in dealing with this. I could go on in this vein, but I think the best I can do at this point is to tell you how serious an issue I think it is.
Hello, my name is Matt. I'm a grad student. I also did my undergrad here, and I'm a proud transfer student. And the question I have in this whole debate we're having with the room is, how do we better bring in the transfer student experience, especially for students who miss really the first 2 years of our OSCE formation?
Right. OSCE formation, I like that.
I haven't heard that before.
Yeah, you know, just to go back again, most of you know this, but one of the parts of the master plan as it was constructed in 1960 by the university in partnership with, at that time, Governor Brown. Sounds good. some things change and other things don't. But was the notion that that we would aspire as a system to take a third of our students as transfer students. And it's been a remarkable achievement, and it continues. It's not quite 34% across the whole system. Berkeley is somewhat lower, but it's still a substantial number. And although, again, if you start looking at the actual data, you see that students who transfer to Berkeley actually don't come from all the community colleges. There are some in particular that are almost like feeder schools, and some like Berkeley City College, which is right here in Berkeley, has programs that allow interactions of different kinds, students to begin taking courses up on campus, interns, to work in the schools, and familiarity to begin to really be cultivated before the transfer moment takes place. You also know that it's still a big walk up that hill. And if it's a big walk up that hill, it's an even bigger walk up from other community colleges. And we have, you know, of course, like other UC campuses, we have programs that are dedicated to working with transfer students. I've been concerned that 2 years really isn't enough. You know, as we talk a lot about the importance of these first 2 years, we're talking about the importance both educationally but also in a way developmentally. But they're both part of
experiencing the breadth of this campus. And if you have to come and just insert yourself into your major program and do nothing other than what is necessary to fulfill your requirements in a two-year period, you really are putting blinders on that make it impossible to take in even a fraction, as other students are able to do, of what's available more broadly. And I think that is a challenge that that then, you know, overdetermines some of the kinds of challenges transfer students have. It takes already what are the struggles that any transfer student, just by virtue of coming into an institution halfway through, will have. And I think that's true in any place where you transfer, although it's, I think, additionally true when you transfer from a very different kind of institution. And it then enjoins us as an institution to find ways to deal with that. I mean, if I had my druthers, I would find a way to both use summers and potentially extra semesters to build in a more compressed version of a kind of two-year elective or core curricular preface to the transfer experience, so that there would be not just OSCE formation, but that kind of Berkeley form. You know, we have lots of different terms here. But one interesting one, just vis-a-vis the question of undergraduates and graduates and research faculty and the like, is that many undergraduates will say they went to Cal. If you're talking about sports, you're obviously talking about Cal. For the longest time, I would watch California play sports when I was on the East Coast, and I didn't know it was Berkeley. I confess, I thought it was just, you know, representatives from UC. I mean, that's right. I know a lot better now, but the experience that you have that then predicates both the intellectual the full intellectual accomplishment and also what we're sort of engaged in talking about here, not just identity formation in the reductive sense, but identity formation in the sense in which this place really does become part of your being in ways that empowers you beyond your particular major to go on and take what you've learned here to be the foundation for whatever else you do is something that I think for transfer students is a special challenge that again produces glorious results because our transfer students come in and they perform spectacularly well. I hear faculty group after faculty group say they actually love the transfer students in particular because they are just so eager to be here, so dedicated to taking advantage of their time here. There's no sophomore slump for transfers, but you know, there's also not that opportunity to take as much full advantage as possible at the campus.
We have time for one more question.
Who's on first?
I was interested in your comment earlier about trying to create a microcosm of a large urban environment in UC Berkeley's campus. And this morning we heard from Michael Jackson at USC, who talked on one of his slides about specifically having USC use Los Angeles as a living and learning laboratory, an extension of the campus. And so I'm thinking about sort of this sort of town-gown relationship. You look at situations like in Cambridge, Massachusetts now, where between Harvard and MIT, they control more real estate than the actual towns do at this point. You know, how when you're on the border of a large urban environment like San Francisco, you know, how much do you want to encourage the sort of cross and out of campus experience versus the in campus experience? You know, to fully leverage the community that you're in, I guess is what I'm trying to ask.
Yeah, no, it's a great question. I'm sorry that I missed Michael's presentation about what USC has done, which has done so much in the world of undergraduate education. So I'm sure we'd have a lot to learn from that. But in terms of town gown things here, I'll start and then Claude, you can perhaps add. But town gown is already, it is in post-structuralist terms, always already part of the Berkeley student experience. It is. Students come here, for example, a third of our undergraduates engage in community service of some sort. And they come here in part to do that. Because there's that kind of service mission that I think is so broadly shared. Students will not only engage in community service projects, they'll get involved in other kinds of things, including political activities, but they will intern to work in schools, both in Berkeley and elsewhere. And you find them, whether it's the Berkeley Project that dedicates several Saturdays of the year to just doing kind of chores around the community, to looking at Berkeley students who work in Berkeley High or Richmond High or high schools in Oakland, a real sense that, you know, they want to be part of the world. We have, as one of the dimensions of the undergraduate initiative here, we've been focusing on arts and design, and one of the things that we're in the process of creating now is something called a culture pass. And a culture pass is the idea that every student at Berkeley will have ways to take advantage not just of cultural performances, exhibitions, events of different kinds on campus, but in the broader Bay Area as well. And it's a way to get students out. It's a way to make sure that there are experiences of the arts and, more broadly speaking, design as well. But that's a wonderful way to engage the resources of the community more broadly. And, of course, the Culture Pass is trying to make that as inexpensive as possible for all of our students by a combination of subsidization through fundraising with basically block tickets being provided at very low cost by presenting organizations that engage us in a long-term relationship. But again, that's just two examples, I think, of where we are as a community. But I do think that for many students, the town is really just as important as the gown. Claude, do you want to add?
Well, this is, I think, one of the strengths of a great big public university in an urban area, Oakland, Richmond, San Francisco, is the membrane between the community and the university is pretty thin here. And our students live out in the community, and their values are shaped by that community as much as by the university often. And so you have a sense of the DNA of a place like this being pretty enabling a very easy movement back and forth between the inside and the outside of the institution. Sometimes we wish we had more ability to hold them in and do some more of the socialization ourselves, as opposed to having the broader world do it. But I think the publicness of this place. And this is a site of the Berkeley's campus. Interesting to me, coming here, is thought of locally and regionally as a site where the public can express itself. And it the public shows up to do that on a pretty regular basis.
Yes, it does. I just want to add one last thing, though, to that, which is, of course, one of the big problems we have with our town is it's getting a lot of wealth injected into it from the prosperity of Northern California. And what we're finding increasingly, of course, is just rental costs. I mean, students used to find it cheaper to live in the open market than in our dorms, and now it's very quickly become the other way around. That actually may be one of the biggest challenges going forward if this process of gentrification at the level that it's happening across the East Bay continues, and then we'll have other kinds of things that we'll have to deal with.
Well, please thank the Chancellor and the Provost.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.